I have to go back and look. I don't. I take it to mean a person is capable, or I guess a word that appears twice in this discourse is skillful, someone who's skillful, but you know, I don't remember. I don't even know if it's a good translation. I translated it myself, but. I don't remember my translation. I translated it twice, and I memorized it the first time. But then I realized it was a bad translation. And then I redid it. And I haven't memorized my new version. And what I gave you is the version that they use at Abhayagiri.
So the translation that you did that you gave out to the son a few years back, is that the good one or the bad one?
That's the bad one. Yes, Karen.
I noticed a lot happening from doing this. Even though I meditated for a long, long time, this has really sort of speeded things up all of a sudden. And what I notice is a lot of very intense dreams, a lot of negative dreams. And also, first that, sometimes I'm not sure whether then my tendency is to start doing Vipassana and start labeling thinking or the emotion. Is it best to shift to that or just to go back to the concentration and stay with that during this
So you mean you're having nightmares while you're sitting or at night when you're sleeping?
Well, what I just talked about was sleeping.
Yeah.
More sleeping. But when I wake up and then sometimes I'm up for a while.
And then you sit. I can't answer that for you. You're welcome to go back and forth. I mean, you should have a serious session every day of concentration practice, and then at other times, if you're going to practice other times, you can do what you think is most useful. It might be useful just to sustain the concentration. If you find it, if you are finding it useful, you might want to continue just doing that. There is something to be said about developing a strength of mind that becomes stronger than the pull of difficult mind states. Or difficult thoughts or something. So you just kind of develop that strength, you can override it. And other times you might want to do Vipassana on it. You know, you don't want to always override things. Sometimes you want to look at things carefully. And it's your call, what you think is most interesting and most useful.
And one more thing I notice that's happening during the sitting is that I'll have little periods where I lose a bit of orientation, like up, down,
yeah.
Right. Time of day, and I find that there's a kind of startle in a way.
Uh-huh.
My mind's saying,
yeah.
It's nighttime, you haven't had dinner yet. Or it's Thursday, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I'm a little off balance for a minute. Any thoughts about that?
Well, it's a pretty common phenomena. To have what happens is the mind gets quieter, gets more concentrated. The normal conceptual mind that we use to always orient ourselves in the world quiets down also. And much of the way we perceive the world is actually through the filter of our concepts and our ideas. And so that activity of the mind, the conceptualizing activity of the mind, quiets down. And until you feel comfortable in that state, there's a transition period where some people start having perceptual distortions or perceptual disorientation. And sometimes it's physically, sometimes the body feels really long. The neck suddenly gets really long. You feel really squat. Or you feel really light and you're floating. Various things might happen. It's like the sensations are still coming in and the mind is trying to process it, but it's been freed up from the old way of understanding it and just puts it together in new configurations. And then also, if the conceptual mind has quieted down, then there is no activity of saying, this is Wednesday or this is Thursday. And there could easily be a moment there where a person doesn't even know who they are. Who am I? And since most of us only feel safe in the world if we orient ourselves in the world by who we are, a very clear concept of what's out there, there can be a fear can arise. And one of the hindrances, or one of the obstacles, or one of the kind of bumps in the road in doing any meditation practice, but also concentration, is fear that arises from entering into a way of being in the world with the normal ideas of how things are have settled away. Especially, you know, when there's very little sense or no sense, or very little sense of who I am or that I am even, I exist. And so some people will kind of, sometimes they get very calm, very concentrated, and they're kind of taken off guard. And they, you know, go into a deeper and deeper state, and suddenly they kind of, oh! You know, they kind of get excited or afraid, and they kind of pull themselves out because, you know, oh my God, you know, I don't exist, or who am I? Or, but if I can to continue along this route, I'm going to die, you know. You know, something, some strange, some kind of fears arise like that.
It's quite involuntary. It's not that it feels like pulling myself out is following the fear, really. I mean, it's not that I'm aware anyway.
Right, right. But it just, yeah.
It's just this involuntary startle.
Yeah. Yeah, you're entering into a new domain, entering into the unknown there, and it makes sense. And, you know, to say it's involuntary maybe means you don't, you know, if the mind was very, very still and really watched the processes of mind going on, you wouldn't say it's involuntary. But most people don't have that level of intimacy with themselves, so it happens just like that. And it seems involuntary. But, you know, it's pretty normal. It's not a bad thing. It's just as you continue practicing, you'll get more comfortable in those states, and you get comfortable not needing to know, you know, what day it is. You don't even care anymore.
I think I cared before.
Yeah.
I've noticed over this last 3 or 4 weeks that after, like this morning, I left. And so while I'm in the setting this morning, I'm very concentrated, very calm. And then I leave, and then I just measured how long it took me to be all full of fear and anxiety and everything, all that busy world, and it was before I got home, like 10 minutes. So how can you counteract that? When you settle, you get very calm and very very concentrated, and then you leave, and then you're really sort of like susceptible, sort of tender.
Yeah.
The world comes, all the things that you're exposed to, you know, and mm-hmm. in your life just come flooding in.
Yeah, sometimes the concentration practice or meditation practice can kind of drop your guard, mm-hmm. and then you get a greater impact from the world around you, and you can actually get more disturbed than you were before when you had all your defenses up. And also what you're pointing out to is that concentration, there's very little wisdom in concentration practice. And so you need a fair amount of wisdom in order to navigate through our world and do it in a wise way. And if a person constantly relies on concentration for their peace and sense of well-being, they're relying on something which is not very reliable in the long term. And you might be able to sustain it for more than 10 minutes sometimes, but then you need to go back and get recharged. And so you can do one or two. You can do a number of things. One is you could try to live in such a way that you stay simple, kind of doing one thing at a time. So you do the things you do in the spirit of that, you know, being concentrated, being focused on one thing at a time, having your intention and your actions kind of harmonized, and that can be very helpful, rather than trying to suddenly get in mind, getting dispersed, and doing 10 things at once. The other thing is to do vipassana. Vipassana is where the wisdom comes from. And as you're doing vipassana, you'll learn the skills of how to navigate our reactions, our thoughts, our feelings, and what goes on in the world. And that's really where the wisdom resides, is with vipassana. The other thing that you can do is sit back. I mean, I don't know if it applies to you, but I think sit back and, you know, go for a walk or something, sit back and kind of look at your life and say, what needs to change here? You know, sometimes we have to change our life and change our behavior if you want to live a life that's somewhat more contemplative or in harmony with that. So those are my thoughts. So, yeah.
One thing that I have a similar experience, I usually have a really good meditation in the morning, but then during the day, when I sit in the evening again, I'm very scattered. It takes me about an hour to even get remotely settled. So I banged around on the web for a while to see if I could find any information. And there's a really good accounting of, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he's a monk, and he wrote his whole experience from when he entered the monastery to many years later. And one of the things that he did, having a similar experience, was he just said his meditation word all day long, no matter what he was doing.
Oh, yeah.
Washing dishes, sweeping the floor. And I found that really works really well and much more settled.
Yeah, so some people will, if the breathing is their primary meditation object, they'll stay connected to their breath throughout their day, and kind of it's kind of a dual tracking kind of thing, and it's very helpful to do that. And the meditation word, some people use like a mantra, and they do that. It's many things.
Or even recite
Medha Sutta. The other thing that relates to all this is that the level of calm and joy and delight that can happen in concentrated states is, if it's really intense, it's unreasonable to expect that you'll sustain that in normal life. It'll go away as soon as you leave the meditation state. And so part of working with concentrated states is to learn how to have some equanimity and acceptance around the fact that the benefits that come from it, the states, the good qualities, pass. And having some ability to negotiate that with some equanimity is a very important part of the wisdom of this practice. Oh, there it goes. Rather than say, you know, there it goes, bye-bye. As opposed to, you know, oh, shoot, you know, what did I do wrong? I'm such a terrible meditator. It's only 10 minutes. And, you know, yesterday was 11. I'm going downhill. You know, so just accept that it passes. It will pass. Okay. Yes. Well, you don't have a lot of tasks that you're responsible for, and a lot of obligations, not a lot of work to be done.
So is that intended for a monastic?
Some people find different jobs. You know, you can decide for yourself how you want to interpret that in your life. You know, you have to do what you have to do. But, you know, a lot of people take on a lot. Some people are neurotic in taking on too many responsibilities. Just they sign up for every possible class or task or job, you know, everything. And so sometimes you want to kind of do less. Sometimes it's undharmic to do more dharmic activities and take on more, you know. Yes? Yeah, Allison has them there. They're also on the web, but in our website. But yeah,
I just was going to make a comment about the Metta Sutta. I thought that the first part of it was actually kind of part of the wishing well, like you're wishing that people are unburdened and that they don't have a lot to take care of.
Yeah, it could be the way I've understood it. Is that the Metta Sutta describes again? I think the translation maybe not as literal as it could be, but in my current translation, I actually changed the first phrases a little bit. So it says something like, "For those who seek the state of peace," it's a little bit arbitrary whether it's path or state or the dimension of peace. Those who seek or who want to attain the state of peace, this is what they should do. They should live this way, and there's long lists of things you should do. And then you should also, loving kindness should be an intimate part of your disposition towards the world. You should suffuse the world with loving kindness. And it's those two things together which are important. In the end of the sutta, they talk about no longer being reborn in this world. And this is the final attainment in Buddhism. So loving kindness by itself is not enough to attain that. But loving kindness is a very important element of the character of a person who's going towards that attainment. Because it says in the end of the sutta, you know, that the person no longer has any sense desires. And the person doesn't hold to fixed views, has clarity of vision. So metta by itself is not sufficient, but it's a very important element in the overall path of practice. So I see the sutta, you know, most people read the sutta as being championing loving kindness, since the bulk of it is about loving kindness. But I see the sutta as being really about the path towards liberation, with loving kindness being a very important element of it. And in any case, it could be, but your interpretation is beautiful, as long as you remember to include yourself, that you wish that for yourself, that you have all those things. You don't just say, well, those people can do it, but I'm going to be busy and burdened and conceited and proud and...
That's the old one.
What happened with that was that I found a translation that I really liked, more than any of many ones that I could find. But the problem was that I had no idea. It was the one that Zen Center in San Francisco chanted, but no one could tell me who had translated it. And the publisher wouldn't publish it unless they knew. So I didn't want to go with any others. And I liked kind of what was in that one. So I redid it. I didn't really translate it the first time. I just redid it in such a way that there wasn't any copyright problems. You know, I kind of had the right, you know. And then I think it was earlier this year or last year, earlier this year, I think, I started looking at that and looking at the Pali. And I was, oh, gee, I don't think that's, you know, I don't want to, this is too, you know. It's not literal enough. So then I went back and made a more literal translation.
So you're saying that the version they use at Zen Center, you don't know?
No one at Zen Center knows where it's from.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I like it a lot. Okay, so let's do a sitting. And... who would like to recite the Metta Sutta at the beginning of our sitting today? It'd be really nice if someone volunteered, because then I wouldn't have to burden someone by calling them out. Who would like to give it a shot?
I'll do it.
Okay. So next week, everyone's expected to have memorized, and we'll recite it together. So please be sure by next week to have it down. Okay. So everybody, make themselves comfortable, and when you feel everyone's a little bit settled, you can start.
If this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward. And straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be these. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near or far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child from the child, so with a boundless heart she might cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free of false sense desires, is not born again in to this world.
So I've talked about concentration involving unification or integration of different factors, harmonizing, working together for the purposes of getting concentrated. And we can talk about the mind and the body being together in the same place at the same time. And another important factor that gets unified with those first two is our intention. That our body and mind and intention are harmonized, working together. That we intend to hold our awareness here, in this present moment, in this body. Hold the mind here. In order to do that, it's helpful if you approach the practice of meditation, concentration, with a respectful attitude. A kind attitude. With loving kindness, friendliness towards yourself. With the respect for not only the practice you're doing, but also respect for yourself for doing the practice. With an appreciation of the importance of the practice that you're undertaking. That for this time of sitting, this is the most important thing that you could be doing. Or at least one of the important things you can do. So that you can put your heart into it. A heartfeltness. So then composing yourself, composing your body, your mind, your heart, to predispose it to be interested in becoming concentrated or stilled, to be settled and steady on your breathing, so that you can make a fuller contact with the breathing. It can be helpful to take a few deeper, longer, slower breaths at the beginning. It can be helpful to trust your breathing, the process of meditative breathing. Trust that it'll take care of you, and with its own patient way, you'll settle the active mind, and settle for now the various feelings and thoughts that pull you away. Keep you scattered. Sometimes I think of the breathing as being like an umbrella. It doesn't stop the rain, but the water just washes off the sides. You can stay with your breathing, one breath after the other. That's staying with the breath. Doesn't stop your thoughts or your feelings automatically, but they just wash off the side. You don't get involved with them, you don't react to them. They just wash off the side. Bring the awareness to your breathing, and then steady the awareness on the breath. Perhaps there can be a feeling of having the awareness rooted in the breath body, that part of the body that breathes, rooted in your body. And as you relax, as you let your body relax, perhaps your awareness can fill your body with the breathing at the center. Might be helpful if you can, as you exhale, to let the thinking mind become still. Let go of your thoughts as you exhale. And let the mind, this thinking mind, become still like a placid surface of a lake. Let your attention become steady on the breath. Let the awareness attach itself to the breathing. Sometimes it's helpful to appreciate the stillness in the body or the stillness around you. And that appreciation of stillness can sometimes help you stay connected with the breathing, as if the breathing occurs or is contained within a field of stillness, nurturing stillness. And then while you stay with each in-breath and out-breath, if it's possible, see if you can let the breathing gladden you, bring some joy or some delight, as if you're fanning the flames of a fire with the breathing. See if you can kind of let the mind, the heart, the body become even just lightly, soft, little bit delighted or happy. As you exhale, let there be a letting go, a kind of letting go that brings a kind of mild joy or delight. And then while staying connected, staying rooted in your breathing in the body, see if you can notice if there's any feelings or sensations of pleasure, joy, delight within your body, no matter how subtle. Look around your body and find that which is pleasant connected to your breathing. And if you find some pleasure or some delight or joy, let the breathing be like wind which is fanning the flames of that joy or that pleasure. To let the pleasure or the delight or the joy spread or diffuse outwards through your body. Or maybe it's a sense of light, white light. Let it become stronger and spread out throughout your body as you breathe. Highlight that corner of your experience which has some joy or some pleasure as part of it, or some sense of ease. And as you stay with the breathing, see if you can almost let that feeling of ease or pleasure, happiness, delight, spread through your body, your mind, your heart. Remembering to let go of your thoughts. Every time you breathe out, letting the mind become still. So with a still mind, you can tune into the stillness, the pleasure, the ease or that might be found in your body, in your mind. If you do feel any delight or ease or pleasure, it might stay very subtle, and that's fine, or it might get stronger. And there's no need to put any bounds on how intense it gets. Let it get as intense as it wishes. You're allowed to really let the enjoyment fill you. If making a small little half smile helps with that joy or pleasure, you might try that out. If your mind tends to be distracted easily, then stay with your breathing. Take a real interest in your breath. Fall in love with your breathing. Appreciate the beauty of breathing at ease. If it's relatively easy to stay with the breathing, at this point, let go of any special attention to the breath. Let go of any attempt to be particularly with the breath. If you stay with the breath, that's fine, but relax that effort of focusing on the breathing intentionally in favor of kind of immersing yourself more fully in the stillness or the joy or the delight. Kind of like if you immersed yourself in a very comfortable pool of water. You lowered yourself into the water. Lower yourself in, submerge yourself in whatever cool, delightful, comfortable feelings there are in your body. Joy, the happiness. If it helps you, you can a few times very quietly say in your mind, whisper to yourself, joy or delight or happiness. Perhaps to help evoke these states more strongly. You might find that to be thinking about anything at all at this point, normal thinking that you do, talking to yourself, maybe it feels rather coarse. Feels like it takes a lot of work. If you want to let the mind discover its deep possibility of rest, see if you can put to rest your tendency to think. Letting the mind become like a placid pool, still lake, spacious, cool. If you still feel some delight or pleasure or joy, continue to let it suffuse all the parts of your body, your torso, head, arms, hands, legs and feet. As if you're sitting in a bubble of stillness or joy or ease. Or if what you see is white light or yellow light or some colored light, let it envelop you. And now within your experience, see if you can highlight whatever feelings, however subtle they might be, whatever some sense or feeling of peace or ease. Be it either mental or physical or heartfelt, even just if it's a hint of it. And highlight the peace or the ease. Let everything else fall away. As if you're enveloping yourself in a soft, clean cotton blanket. Let the peace and the ease envelop you, making you feel very content, safe, at ease, at home, with the mind becoming very still, content in itself. And then take the last minute or two of the sitting to let go of any holding to anything you have and review what that sitting was like for you. What happened to you as you sat here? What worked? What didn't work for you in terms of getting filled with joy or peace or delight, getting concentrated? Let your mind think about this. Of the Buddhist path is to realize our potential to not cling, to be in the world without clinging to anything whatsoever, to release the heart, the mind, from all the things that keeps it constricted or tight or afraid or angry or bitter or confused. Experience of release, of freedom, of unclinging. Concentration practice is in the Buddhist path is not an end in itself. It's a means for helping us do that. It's a means to help us let go of our clinging. And so we have to always remember that, that we're not doing this for its own sake, in order to be filled with joy or light or for its own purposes. But we do these things in order to help us to have the stability of mind and the clarity of mind to really begin addressing the deeper issues of clinging. This is partly a review. There are a lot of benefits to concentration practice. One is it stabilizes and clarifies the mind, develops a strength of mind that helps us be more focused in our normal life, regular life, outside of meditation. It gives us a sense of feeling unified, calm, which is very helpful. It can bring a lot of joy, a sense of well-being or a sense of contentment with it. And this provides a very important shift in perspective about who we are and who we are in the world and how we feel and what are the values that we want to live our life by. One of the reasons why concentration practice is sometimes taught is that the joy that can come from concentration meditation can give you a very different sense of how to experience joy in your life, so that you don't necessarily feel like you have to go rushing out and fill it with maybe unwholesome forms of joy or other kinds of things. It helps shift the priorities so that what's called worldly joys, their lure is lessened. They don't seem as interesting anymore because you have this thing, you know, this thing which is much more satisfying than, you know, any kind of worldly joy or most kinds of worldly joys that you might experience so far. And part of the reason why this is valuable according to the Buddhist path is that it's very hard to free ourselves from our clinging to worldly joys. And so rather than just simply telling you, don't cling to those things, in part you're given this better carrot, this better thing, to better kind of joy, so you kind of loosen the clinging to those lesser happiness. The Buddha said something like, a wise person would give up a lesser happiness in order to attain a greater happiness. So this is considered the greater happiness. Not an end in itself, but because it's really helpful then as we go continue along the path of letting go and letting go. It also, as we get more concentrated, it's one of the ways that we tend to let go of self-preoccupation. And so again, gives us a different perspective on who we are. Because if you get concentrated, it's very hard to continue having those kinds of thoughts, ruminations, preoccupations, of, you know, oh, me, myself and mine, my problems, my concerns, my desires, my ambitions, who I am. Because all those kinds of concerns are kind of coarse elements of the mind. When the mind is really still, those things aren't operating. And to discover that you can let all those kind of problems of our life, our self, fall away and feel a very deep sense of contentment and ease and happiness without having fixed any of those problems gives us a very different perspective on those kinds of self-preoccupying concerns that we might have. And that can be very helpful to see that. It might give a very different perspective on, you know, what we think we need to do in order to feel happy, when we can be happy without fixing ourselves. And then it's also, concentration practice is a foundation for the deepest work of insight meditation, of vipassana. And I'm very fond of the fact that in Chinese, that when they translated the words for concentration, they used the character for stop. And when they translated the word for mindfulness, they used the character for looking. Stop and look. And the concentration practice helps us to stop so that we can really look carefully at what's happening here and now. So part of samadhi practice, concentration practice, is not only entering into a state of concentration, but almost more important is developing some mastery, some real skill in being able to do this. So it's not just a matter of, you know, putting in the time and the effort, or, you know, wishful thinking or hoping that it happens, or just by luck every once in a while you seem to get concentrated, but beginning to have some sense that you have some ability, some skill at doing what it takes to support the possibility of getting concentrated. Sometimes it feels, and some people will say, that you can't make yourself concentrated. Concentration is something that happens, but you can become skilled in creating all the conditions that allows concentration to ripen. Some people feel you can kind of develop concentration directly. But in either case, you develop a skill in either way, either helping you create the conditions for it to happen, or you develop the skills to do it directly. And concentration, you know, is a, for most people, for people who are not trained themselves, is a kind of a semi-autonomic or semi-unconscious kind of process, that sometimes we kind of direct our attention to pay attention to various things. You know, if you turn on a television, most of us will direct our attention to the television. And we have that ability to change our attention on will. But to really do it, to have really power and mastery over that, so that we have ability to really direct and hold our attention even when things are not interesting or fascinating in and of themselves. That we can choose where we keep our mind, develop mastery of that, and then more importantly, not only mastery over being constant, being focused, but mastery over learning how to develop the joy and the light, the peace and the calm that can come from getting concentrated. So it's a skill that we develop. So and in the path of concentration, it's very much part of developing this skill. So it may be helpful to think of it as a skill that you're learning. So as concentration develops, it brings with it new states of mind and feelings. And as the meditation deepens, an intensification of these feelings, these states. And part of the path of concentration is an intensification of states. It's not just simply, you know, more and more peace and calm, which it's actually intensification. Sometimes it gets very intense, the states that might arise. There was a time where, for me, where the concentration got very, 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 very intense, and it was almost, you know, nothing left in my experience, because concentration practice is a kind of withdrawal of attention from the sense world, the world around you. Don't hear sounds anymore and the things outside of you if you're really intensely absorbed, and you don't even maybe experience your body. And there was a time I was very concentrated. There was no more experience of my body and certainly of the world around me, and very little was left of my state, the very states of mind. It was very, very focused, absorbed state of mind. And I got very absorbed in very intense white light. The light got stronger and stronger. And at some point, the whole kind of concentrated state kind of began to break apart when I got nauseous, because it was so intense. So it can be very, very intense sometimes. You don't Don't hold on to some idea that it's only about becoming calm and peaceful. You get calm and peaceful up to a point, in a sense, compared to our normal street consciousness, and more settled. And then as you go deeper into it and the concentration develops, then sometimes there's an intensification of various factors that happens. So the path of concentration then involves entering into states of concentration, not just simply having the mind concentrated, but entering into the whole states where the whole psychophysical sense of who you are, sense of being, shifts from normal way which we are. And sometimes, and this is traditionally in Pali, in Theravada Buddhism, is called entering the jhanas. In Sanskrit, it's called dhyana. And it's the word for Zen. Dhyana became chan in China and Zen in Japan. But this idea of being concentrated, entering into these jhanic states. And sometimes it's very difficult to translate this into English. And my favorite translation is absorption, because you're really absorbed. And absorption usually has the connotations of being really interested in what's going on. You're absorbed, you're interested. There's often a kind of joy that comes with being interested. And being absorbed in what's happening. Sometimes, I think wrongly, you've seen literature, it's translated as being in trance. But trance, I think, has connotations of kind of losing a certain kind of presence of mind. There's a wide range of altered states of consciousness that human beings can experience. And what's interesting is that in the traditional maps of states of mind, the Buddha and the later Buddhist psychologists didn't enumerate all the different varieties that you can experience. They focused on particular ones that, as far as I can tell, all pretty much, except for very rarefied states, are all characterized by a very strong sense of presence of mind. So you're not going unconscious. You know, it's like you go into a trance state or a shamanic possession where you don't even know that you're talking like a wolf or something, and you come out of it and people say, oh, you know, you're channeling this, you know, thing. There's not that kind of trance. There's kind of a very clear presence of mind in these states. So I think that because in Buddhist practice, the idea of being aware has very, very high priority. Staying aware, staying present for what's happening. Now, these jhanas are absorptions to the point of exclusion of or withdrawal of, from this, the world around us, from the normal activities of certain normal activities of life, but also withdrawal from interest in sights, sounds, creaky floors. You wouldn't even notice those things if you're totally absorbed. Sometimes it's called a seclusion of mind, which I talked about Monday night. The mind is secluded or entered into a kind of a solitude in itself. It's withdrawn into itself, the mind, the body, into the inner process. Normal sensations, perceptions, cognitive activity kind of tend to fall away. A lot of it tends to fall away. And that's why there's sometimes some disorientation that happens, and sometimes fear that arises as part of this, because we're so sometimes feel insecure if we have our thoughts and our normal feelings and things there. The mind which enters into these absorptions is often described as being a mind which is cleansed. It's without blemish. It's purified. It's very soft, pliable, malleable. Now, last week I talked about what's called access concentration. And access concentration is a state of mind, state of concentration, where the hindrances, the strong forces of preoccupation, things that tend to preoccupy us very much, are no longer bothering you, no longer have a hold on you. For whatever reason, you can get it to no longer grab you. You're no longer interested in that. The mind doesn't go there anymore. It simply does not interested in sensual pleasure anymore. It doesn't get pulled in that direction, or ill will, or sloth and torpor, or doubt, anxiety. Those things are at bay. So the mind then, because it's at bay, not pulled or fragmented into those directions, the mind becomes much more workable, becomes something you can start really using it to stay focused. As a person gets into access concentration, It's kind of like a little, you know, brand new toddler, some little baby just beginning to learn to stand. And it stands, and it can stand for a few seconds or a minute or something, and it falls. And then, you know, over the days and the weeks, it learns to stand longer and longer until after a while it can stand at will for, you know, for a long time. So an access concentration is often kind of unstable. And it's very easy, you enter into it a little bit, and then we fall out of it, and the hindrances come back. And then we muster ourselves up, we apply ourselves, we focus ourselves, we let go, we reinvigorate our inspiration, our faith, whatever it takes to kind of get the hindrances at bay. And then you kind of get into access concentration again. At some point, you know, sometimes there are very classical kind of technical descriptions of what's supposed to happen when. I think sometimes they're a little bit overly done. I think it's a kind of a spectrum of things that happen to some degree. But at some point, it's not just simply of letting the five hindrances fall away. Also, there's the arousing, rising of five other factors. So there's five factors which are put to rest, in a sense, get out of the way. And then there's five factors that, in a sense, replace them. And actually, sometimes in the texts, they talk about how the hindrances are the five things that arise are the antidote to the five hindrances. And these five things that arise are called the five jhanic factors, the five factors of absorption. And now, not every time that you get concentrated very strongly do these five have to arise. But in order to enter into the Buddhist notion of jhanas, these very useful states, these five are what can really start getting highlighted and start becoming predominant in your experience. So there is, these five are the initial, what's called the initial application of mind, of attention, initial application of attention, and then the sustained application of attention, which we talked about before. Then the next, the third one is joy. The Pali word is piti, P-I-T-I. The fourth is happiness, sometimes translated as ease, sometimes bliss. And that's sukha, which is the opposite of dukkha. And then the fifth factor is ekagata, which is one-pointedness of mind, the mind to be one-pointed. So these five healthy jhanic factors are said to be the antidote for the hindrances. So I can't remember that well, but let me see. The initial application of mind is an antidote to sloth and torpor, because you're applying energy. The sustained attention is an antidote to... I'll cheat to look. I wrote it down. I thought I wrote it down. Yeah. It said it's an antidote to skeptical doubt. Because doubt, you know, you get caught up in all the kind of thoughts. And now you kind of your whole cognitive world is kind of sustained, attentive, staying focused. So there's no space in the mind to start thinking about, you know, doubt. And then the joy, the piti, sometimes translated as rapture, is an antidote towards ill will. They say it's very hard to have ill will when you're filled with joy. And then happiness is said to be an antidote to restlessness. Because we'll talk about happiness in a little while, but you'll see happiness, that kind of the deep happiness of this jhanic factor is a very settled, certainly unrestful state. The mind is very settled and contented in itself. And then ekagata, one-pointedness, is said to be an antidote for desire. I'm not sure why that's... It could be an antidote to almost any of it. Certainly an antidote to ill will also, but it's said to be an antidote to desire. So it's very neat to have these five kind of matched up like that. But in any case, these five hindrances are no longer... Nothing really grabs you. Nothing really pulls you away. You're really kind of settled and ready to kind of get into the practice, be absorbed, to be intent. You're not interested in other things. You're not pulled away by other things. And then these other five factors then begin arising. And they might be very subtle at first, and it's considered very... As you get more concentrated, more absorbed in your subject of meditation, the breath or the metta meditation, whatever it is, these things become stronger. And it's possible also to start recognizing these, having some ability, some skill at recognizing the arising of joy, of happiness, of one-pointedness, and then fueling it, intensifying it. And part of the art of getting into the jhanas and then develop and the art of kind of playing within the jhanas is learning how to intensify especially the joy and the happiness part of it. When we did a sitting just now, how many of you were able to highlight some feeling of joy or ease or happiness, and then also were able to intensify it to some degree, let it become more pervasive through your kind of psychophysical system? Is that something you had some ability to do? Some people, sometimes it can be evoked, you know, you can actually say joy. And especially people who, do, if you do a lot of this kind of practice, and your mind it becomes a kind of a habit or in a groove of this kind of practice, then a person can, it's a lot easier just to evoke these things. You can just kind of say the word joy. Or sometimes you can just say the name of first jhana or second jhana, and you can sometimes just evoking of it. The mind is very powerful, dropping a word. And the mind, when it's, it can be, the mind is very powerful, we all know that. And now the power of the mind is being used for very wholesome purposes. It's like, you know, if you, some people have the ability, and if you go to sleep at night, and you just resolve to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning or a certain time the next morning, some people, you know, can do that. Just suddenly they wake up, and somehow the power of the mind kind of operates in a kind of subconscious way where you make a resolve, something can be evoked. And the same thing, that's power of the mind to evoke, to make resolves and to evoke certain things, becomes sometimes very strongly functioning. When a person's done a lot of jhanic practice, especially if they're on a retreat and it becomes they're really close at hand. So I'll go through these. I'll talk about these jhanas. As I do that, the warning is that this is one of the places where more Buddhists probably suffer than almost any other place of meditation. They strive hard to attain these things and they get headaches trying, or they despair at not attaining it, or they get impatient because it takes 20 years, or things are not happening as fast as they expect to, or not happening as fast as their neighbor who's getting into these jhanas right away. And there's just a lot of suffering is possible here. And so you have to be very careful that you have a lot of wisdom and a lot of vipassana wisdom to understand how to work with these states and really good foundation, understanding what the path is, understanding what you are, and understanding your priorities so that you don't suffer because you've heard about these as a possibility. There are some teachers who actually refuse to talk about these things. Ajahn Sumedho, for example, I believe he never talks about jhanas. He doesn't like to. He, as a policy, doesn't want to talk about it because he finds that they cause more harm in his circles than they have benefits. There's a whole range of philosophies and attitudes towards the jhanas in the Buddhist tradition. And some people insist that the only way to getting liberated is through the jhanas. Jhanas are not the way to get liberated, but you have to go through them and you have to do them. And some people say you don't have to do them at all and you just ignore them and you just do the more important work of vipassana. And there's all these opinions and they bicker and they argue with each other and say the other person's got it wrong. So these jhanas, or Buddhist meditation in general, but jhanas are a source of a lot of difficulty. So you have to kind of take them with have a lot of wisdom when you hear all this. But anyway, I thought it was useful to have you be a little bit familiar with these states. Some of you might already be fairly familiar with them, and some of you might be interested in these, and knowing about these might help you as you practice to get more absorbed, more intent, more involved in your meditation. So the first jhana is the first five factors. These five factors are getting intensified. So the mind is absorbed, one-pointed on the object of attention, in this case, mostly I'm talking here in this class, the breath. And the hindrances are at bay, and there's a strong sense of the presence of applied it, initial application of attention, the sustaining of attention, the one-pointedness of that sustained attention, the arising of joy, and the arising of happiness. All those things need to be present in the first jhana. And they might be present a little bit different balances in different ways, but if you look around in that first jhana, you kind of recognize that all those are there. There might be a lot of other things, other factors that might be also present. There might still be some thinking going on. Some discursive thought might be going on. And the first jhana is said that you can attain without going into being in meditation. Certain, can happen spontaneously in people's lives, that they enter into a very deep sense of joy and absorption, of contentment, of happiness, and the mind very still and very focused. And there might still be some rumination, some thoughts that are floating, free-floating around. And that's, you know, okay in the first jhana. And the idea is to kind of get into, you know, be familiar with this. Once a person's entered the first jhana, one tradition is that you want to be very, you don't want to be in a hurry to go into the second jhana, the second shift of consciousness, shift of awareness. The Buddha said that if you go quickly, it's like a cow who's in its pasture. Before it really knows its pasture, it's already broken the fence to go into the next pasture. And you want to stay and really explore your pasture first. So the idea is really, once you feel this kind of psychic shift, changing of gears in the mind, that where you kind of feel like you're now absorbed and these factors are somewhat present, you want to stay there and become familiar with those. That you want to become familiar with a number of things. You want to become familiar with how you got into it, and you want to pay attention to how you emerge from it. And maybe if you have some ability to go back and forth. And get some skill there. Kind of massage it and work with it. Don't be in a hurry to get somewhere else. And then once you're somewhat familiar with it, then you're ready to go into the second jhana. And the second jhana is very interesting because here what's highlighted of these five different factors is the joy. And the first two, the initial and the sustained application of attention, they're dropped. And here in the second jhana, there might be a stray kind of thought here and there. But there's not really any discursive thinking going on. The normal way in which we kind of, you know, self-talk that goes on in the mind, it's not going to happen much anymore. There might be a stray thought that goes through here and there. But partly it doesn't happen because discursive thinking is a relatively coarse activity of the mind. It's actually tiring for the mind. You feel kind of like you're kind of doing this kind of coarse thing, this agitated thing. And in the second jhana, things are subtle enough now. Your psychophysical state, your attention, your mind is subtle enough that it feels irritating or agitating to be involved in this kind of activity. And you'd rather not. It's obvious you'd rather not. So it's really easy to let go of it because it's just, you know, not interesting. It's not nice, not enjoyable. And instead, you have this much more enjoyable thing to be doing, which is continue being absorbed in the actual joy that's in the second jhana. So to move from the first to the second, it involves a letting go of the initial and sustained application of thought, application of mind, of attention. And this can be understood in different ways. Sometimes it's felt as if you're no longer making any effort to stay focused on the breath. It just seems to happen very naturally on its own, very easily. Just kind of, there's no more, you're not applying yourself at all, just happening. You maybe feel pulled towards the breath, or it has you. Another way it happens is the awareness is no longer focusing at all on the breath, or on metta, or, you know, anything. But rather, it's let go of that kind of concentration, but now it's focusing more on the signs, on the symptoms of being absorbed. And there's a number of signs or symptoms of what it feels like to be absorbed, and one of them is joy. So another one might be an experience of lights, white light or different kinds of light. Some people have a very strong ability to visualize. And as they enter into these deeper states of concentration, sometimes certain visions appear, like flowers or stars. Some people I've talked to see geometrical shapes, lots of geometrical shapes. And it's a symptom of this being absorbed. And so what you do now, the attention almost naturally, because you let go of the applying yourself, gets absorbed or involved in these symptoms or signs of the meditation, of how it feels like to be meditating. So you might actually use this. So especially the joy here. And the joy can get very intense. It can also be very mild, very minor. As a person gets familiar with the second jhana, then the idea is to learn how to intensify the joy. Intensification means suffusing it throughout the body, trying to see if you can spread it. So the whole body feels kind of joy throughout it. And this can be experienced, it said, in five different ways. It's wonderful words. There are categories. It's called, there's minor joy, momentary joy, cascading joy, uplifting joy, and pervading joy. Minor joy is said to be goosebumps all over the body, the hair standing up on end. I've never had it exactly that way, but sometimes it's said this pity, this kind of joy, has all kinds of actually uncomfortable sensations. Sometimes it can feel like all these insects crawling, like ants are crawling across your skin. And I've sat in very deep, you know, very concentrated, and then just finally just had to open my eyes to, you know, and there's no ants there. You know, I could have sworn I was, you know, they were all over me and there's nothing there. And sometimes the feeling of the skin crawling, you know, your skin's crawling. Sometimes earlier his mind starts getting really concentrated, but it's before you enter into a jhana or getting absorbed. There are other symptoms of kind of joy that might arise in the system like that it might happen. One of them some people have is different muscles can feel or actually can tighten up a little bit. Or there can be very strong buzzing or vibration, sometimes like in the third eye area, or sometimes around the face, the jaw, the mouth. The mouth might feel getting all puckered up or tight or taut. It's a symptom of concentration. Sometimes the eyes even sometimes can feel a little bit taut and tight. If it feels like it's a problem, you can always then bring your attention to those and do vipassana on them. But if it feels like it's very much part of getting concentrated, you might just be patient with it. And as you get deeper into concentrated state, those sensations will fall away. The body will relax deeper or something will happen. It's kind of like a stage a person, people will go through. But anyway, there can be minor joy. There's momentary joy, which is said to be like flashes of lightning through your body. Just suddenly there's this flash of lightning. And it could be very strong. It can be very, very small. Sometimes I had the feeling of these little explosions of light and joy, of energy. Just kind of like, I thought maybe there were acupuncture points in my body. Just like strange little point. and they seem to radiate out in like one track, one direction. So it must be, meridians, that they're following. Who knows? But this kind of just momentary. And then there's showering joy, which can feel like this, waves and waves just washing through you, just like you're being showered, a wave kind of pouring through you, one after the other. And sometimes this intense kind of showering joy can remain after a sitting. And I remember sometimes on retreats, leaving a concentrated state and going to lunch, and not being able to eat, because every time I lift up my utensil, just a movement of my body somehow, I would just be showered, just a wave, cascading wave of joy would just break through me. And I closed my eyes. I couldn't handle it, And I would, try again, And I just, you know, it took me forever to get out of the dining hall. You know, just showering. And then there's uplifting joy. The body feels like it's just suddenly very light, like you're floating almost. That can happen. And then there's pervading joy. The joy just kind of very pervades, suffuses the whole body. So these are fine things to happen. And the classic description in the suttas is of a mountain pond, a lake, that's spring-fed. And there's no water coming in from land, no rivers coming in. But there's a cool spring deep inside the base of this lake. And it's out of that spring comes, floats up or sprays or whatever they do in ponds. The spring kind of flows outwards up into the pond, suffusing the pond with cool, refreshing water. And so this idea of water is very interesting because, again, I don't know if it's Jung, but in, we think of nowadays mythically that water represents the unconscious. And so they have, you know, a lot of these imageries have to do with water. The first jhana, it's almost 9 o'clock. Are you guys still with me? I guess you're used to it now that I go over 10 minutes. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first jhana is described with water also, but here it's like the classic description is you, apparently they had bath soap in the ancient world that was a powder, dry powder. And then they would, if you take water and sprinkle water onto the dry powder, you can make it into a moist ball that's kind of like clay-like, I guess, or and you can hold it into a ball, and you keep kneading it until the whole ball is suffused with the water, completely moist, and pliable and workable. So in the same way, in the first jhana, the mind is suffused with the jhanic factors, and suffused with a certain kind of pliability and workability. And the water, you know, the mixing of these opposites of water and dry powder, somehow the hindrances and the jhanic factors, kind of the opposites, kind of meet or they balance each other out or something, and you have this pliable lump of a mind which you can now use. In the second jhana, you have this, you know, lake with this cool spring water that flows up from underneath and suffuses the whole lake. Sometimes this the second jhana is described as rapture, and because it can be so intense, there still can be happiness there. There's supposed to be happiness, and happiness, one-pointedness, and joy are supposed to both, all three exist in the third jhana. Other things can also exist. Other mental factors can also exist there, but these are the three which are really important, and these are which get highlighted. But in the second, it's mostly the joy. Then, after a person has become adept at the second jhana, then they're directed to notice that the joy and the rapture is agitating. It's actually, you can have too much joy. You know, you get to, after first you feel really high, it's exciting. After a while, you can give me a break. You know, this is actually, you know, just tired. It tires me out to have seems to be. You can imagine, you know, these waves of cascading joy and going on and on and on. After a while, you know, give me a break. You know. I'm so tired of this, you know. Just get, you know. And you know, so, but it's a relatively coarse factor. And as we move from the higher jhanas to the lower ones, we're moving from coarse to more refined states. And rapture and this kind of joy is relatively, compared to deeper states, a coarse phenomena. And then you're trained to think or to understand that this is actually not so, you know, not a particularly good place to dwell anymore. And you want to go to something more refined. And so you see and recognize that it's still agitating, that it's tiring, it's like kind of, it's too, you know, exciting. And there's something more sublime that's possible. And so you direct the mind to let go of the joy in favor of tuning into happiness. And the happiness, the sukha, is considered to be much more sublime. It's not agitating. And it, you know, it depends on kind of how you look at it, the perspective. But It's much more deep in the psyche, deep in the system, the happiness. It's kind of a contented, happy, quieter. It's much more quieter, more satisfying feeling than the joy. And so the person then begins to recognize that and highlight that and begin appreciating this happiness, this ease. It's kind of like an ease in sukha is often sometimes translated as ease. but kind of a much more deeply satisfying happiness, kind of contentment or soothed, happy, delightful feeling. And this is described as being lotus flowers on the surface of a lake, that same lake. And the cool water has not only suffused the whole lake, but now it's suffused and cooled the lotus flowers on top of the lake. I don't quite understand how this image works, actually. But I think what it means is now you're beginning to have some sense that you're not so caught up. So the joy and delight is suffusing the whole body. And now there's kind of a resting on top of it all, kind of floating on top of it all. You're not kind of immersed or submerged so completely in it. Then you realize that the happiness is kind of coarse also. And it's a little bit agitating, a little bit unsatisfactory feeling to it. And then you let go of that happiness. In favor, and this is what's interesting now, is that now there's actually a shift in the whole process. And it's not no longer, you let go of the happiness, and then a new factor arises. And this is the jhanic factor of equanimity, usually translated as equanimity. So there's the arising of equanimity, of a deep state of peace, where the mind is no longer subject to pleasure and pain or being caught by those, subject to what's said in the text, grief and sorrow. The mind is at deep peace with itself, deep equanimity. And this equanimity, this state of peace or equanimity or ease or of being somehow separated from pain and suffering, pain and joy, is so much more deeply satisfying for the psyche than the happiness that was there before it. It can sound like equanimity, it might be a feeling of indifference, maybe, but it's kind of like an emotion, it's very deeply satisfying. So the second and third jhana are the intensification of some sublime and particular kind of emotional states. Those emotional states are let go of in favor of a much more deeply satisfying emotion or feeling or state or state of mind called equanimity. There can be very little contact now with the external world. I mean, you hardly, you know, even with your body sometimes. It's a very rarefied, very peaceful state of mind. Now, why enter these states? Or another description of these states is, which is kind of beautiful, I think, and it kind of maybe characterizes a little bit the difference between joy and happiness, the second and third, is if you're out in the desert and you've run out of water, you've been in the desert for days and days, and it's really hot and you're parched and desperate for water and you're miserable, and you're really, you know, the thing you most want in the world is just to have water. And then you see in the distance, you see an oasis. It's a real one, it's not a mirage. You see an oasis. And you see there's nice, cool trees around the edge of the lake, the oasis. And you're just filled, and you know the water's drinkable. It's a big sign, bulletin board that says, you know, potable water, you know it's safe to drink. And you're just, you know, filled with joy, finally relief, you know. Oh, you feel a sense of relief and joy and expectation. Yeah, yes, you know, I finally arrived and we can be happy and I'm safe. And this joy and excitement and delight arises. And so this contentment to the delight, partly of you're freed from the wilderness of the hindrances. You're not freed from the wilderness and the suffering, the burden of all your normal patterns of thinking and obsessions and fears and anxieties and the ways the mind works. And what, how great. And you see the possibility of greater peace there, of joy. The joy arises from that. Then imagine that you've actually made it to the lake, to the oasis. You've drunk the cool, refreshing water. You had your fill. And you lay yourself down in the shade by the edge of the lake, under the trees. And then you're supposed to, that feeling of kind of ease and content, then you're really happy. You're no longer, there's like excitement and joy. Oh, yes. It's like, oh, yes, I got it. You're relaxed. You can let go. You're no longer hoping and happy about what you're going to get. You're satisfied. So this happiness of being satisfied and being contented, you're much more settled. It's So this is a little bit, sometimes described the difference between the second and third, the kind of happiness that comes in. Equanimity is described in the text because it's kind of a shift that's very different from the others. And there's no longer a water analogy that's being used. But rather, the analogy here is the image is of a person who has surrounded themselves by a cool, by a comfortable, soft, clean cotton blanket. And maybe it's that person who's finally made it to the lake, drunk the water, you know, is happy with having drunk, and then they kind of, maybe they've even taken a dip, and then they lay, and then they kind of have this nice, you know, body length, big, white, you know, really soft towel, and you lay yourself in this towel, and you're completely enveloped in this very comfortable feeling, kind of maybe like a baby enveloped by its mother or something, just very comfortable, kind of, the equanimity is a very comforting feeling. And it kind of, you know, the image of kind of enveloped in this blanket, it's kind of, nothing can touch you anymore. You're not bothered by anything anymore. You're so contented and settled in yourself. There's a kind of sense of equanimity, sense of safety, of ease. Now, as a footnote, it said that the fourth jhana, when the mind is in this state, that's the state, because the mind is so much at peace, so still and so concentrated, because one pointedness is still there, that the mind is very, very workable, and now that some of the more refined capacities of the mind can be developed, the very, very refined things that normally in coarse minds can't be developed at all. And these are sometimes, some of the things that can be developed are the psychic factors, psychic abilities. I'm agnostic about it. I don't know what these are about. But the Buddhist tradition makes a big deal about them here and there. And when I was in Thailand, you know, people would say, oh, that person there, you know, he can read your thoughts, or, you know, or he knows what we're going to have for lunch the day before. and the ability to levitate and to fly and to read people's minds and to hear things from a distance. Sometimes when people get very concentrated, I've had this experience, I feel like I can hear things that are, I don't think it's a psychic ability. I just, you know, I'm more rational, but I think, you know, it's not like I can hear things the other side of the world, but I can hear things like, you know, much further away than I normally can, because the system is so sensitive. But the psychic abilities. Some people feel that the fourth jhana is the best foundation for doing vipassana practice. And other people say, well, you know, other things. And it's the state from which the Buddha died, the fourth jhana, that state of peace, equanimity of that state. So what I'd like you to get from this class today is the idea of that it's, as you develop your concentration practice, it can actually be helpful to start tuning in and highlighting some of these factors, especially the symptoms of getting concentrated, symptoms or signs of getting concentrated, like joy or delight or light, white light that might arise. And then to use those as a way of helping you get more concentrated. And there's two ways of doing that. One is to continue with your breathing and let the breathing be kind of like a wind that's, or the bellows that's fanning the flames. And using the joy or the delight or the light that arises as a kind of biofeedback cheerleader that kind of encourages you to stay focused. Or it's kind of like you're continuing to kind of develop that concentration by kind of massaging the breath, massaging those states with the breath each time, massaging it. Or that's one way. And the other way is to forget the breath, let go of the breath if you feel like you're really concentrated and stable enough, and then focus on simply on those signs or symptoms of being concentrated and let them become stronger. You're allowed to intensify and change your experience when you're doing concentration practice. Usually you're not allowed to do that when you do vipassana practice. That's meaning you're being a bad yogi. But you're supposed to just let things be. But in concentration practice, you don't have to let things be. You can be actually actively involved. You're actually supposed to get actively involved so you can get mastery over these things. Develop the skill and the ability to work with these. Develop the ability to evoke them or to recognize them, to turn the attention to these factors, to recognize each of those five factors in turn. Some skill in entering into quickly, to attain it quickly. And some people can do that on retreat. In retreats, sometimes I can relatively quickly move into a concentrated state. In daily life practice, I won't say that I'm quick. But, you know. And then this is interesting, a resolving. It's a very fascinating practice with the jhanas, where you, before you go into it, you resolve how long you're going to stay in it. And you can resolve different things to happen when you're in that state. It's a little bit difficult to resolve when you're in the state. But you resolve ahead of time, like you do before going to sleep at night, getting up the next morning. And then that sets in motion various things happening. For example, people can resolve, I'm going to stay in this jhana, in the first jhana, or the second jhana, or third jhana, for 20 minutes, for an hour, for certain periods of time. And then after 20, 30, whatever the resolve has been, you come out of it. Can you imagine? It's really, the mind is really an amazing, amazing phenomenon. And then the person gets mastery over coming out of it quickly, letting go of it quickly. And then there's mastery, and there's also an important part of it is reviewing the whole phenomena. And then I keep emphasizing this in this class, is before you leave your meditation session, you want to spend some time reviewing how that was like. And if you enter into the jhanas, you want to spend some time reviewing how you got into it, what happened, just so you help you develop that skill by reviewing and familiarizing yourself with it all. So you're allowed to feel joy and you're allowed to intensify it. So you might, during this next week, experiment with that and see if you can you don't have to be in any jhanic state, but see if you can recognize pleasure, physical pleasure, anywhere. For me, that lips touching is a place where I can easily feel pleasure. Sometimes I touch my fingertips together, and it feels pleasant to me, and I can focus on that. Or sometimes the way the breath feels. Some corner, some little aspect of the breath feels pleasant or gives pleasure. Or some other part of your body. Maybe you feel joy tingling someplace in your body, tingling arising someplace. And so go with that tingling. Intensify it. Let it grow. Let it pervade the body. See if you can see the difference between joy and rapture and a state of happiness. So explore and have fun with this. Play with this if it's accessible to you. If it's not accessible to you, these kinds of things, please don't be burdened by it. Please don't feel like you're a bad meditator. There's people who have very little ability to get concentrated, who do concentration practice, try to get concentrated, focus on doing the practice, and attain a lot more benefit from the practice than some people I know who had really easy time getting into the jhanas. Some people who have really hard time develop a lot more freedom, a lot more wisdom than the people who have a really easy time. So if it's hard for you, this, don't be discouraged. But if any of this helps you, then let it help you, let it support you. Let it become more playful and fun. So is that okay? So I'm sorry to talk over. And next week, I'll be here again early. I'll be here at 6:30. And if anyone, if you want to talk, please come and talk about your practice. If you have any questions about the practice, please be very personal. Even though it's other people are listening, this is really a chance to have an interview and really ask your questions about this practice and how it is for you and, how to proceed from here if you have questions. So please, if you want, come at 6:30, and then we'll have a class next week at 7:30. Okay? Great. Thank you.